If we don't have fair elections and honest voting and machines that work quickly, you know, if you had paper ballots, every election will be over by 10 o'clock in the evening.
So, let me ask you.
You understand what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying. Do you understand what you're saying?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Because it doesn't sound like you do.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
As usual.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also elsewhere in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, Virginia, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and streaming on all of your favorite streaming internet sites and podcast sites and everywhere else. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from BradBlog.com. Thank you for joining us today. As you can tell, we got a lot to get to, and we will get to what Trump thinks he was trying to say about election reform that he is demanding and I guess threatening to implement when he takes office in a bit, with a law professor who calls himself a democracy optimist even now. Even now, Desi Doyen, which we can all use a little optimism, I would argue.
Most certainly.
I have argued. But he's a democracy optimist, even after all that we've seen in recent weeks and months and years, and all that we are up against once Trump takes office next year. He will join us in a bit. But first, it's one of those way too much news days that we saw a lot of during the previous Trump years. And, well, I guess they're back.
Yep. They're back.
The upside, at least from some of that news today, is that at least, well, some of my holiday reading list appears to be coming together nicely. The House Ethics Committee secretly voted. Why secretly? I don't know. But anyway, they voted secretly earlier this month to release its report into the unethical or unlawful conduct of now former Congressman Matt Gaetz before the end of this Congress. That, according to CNN, who says they got the news from multiple sources with knowledge of the matter. Other outlets have since confirmed CNN's reporting. The report is now expected, according to the outlet, to be made public after the House's final day of votes this year as lawmakers leave Washington for the holidays. According to those sources, the vote, which had not previously been reported, amounts to a stark reversal for the bipartisan panel after it had voted along party lines in late November not to release the results of that investigation. All the Republicans on the panel had voted to block its release. All of the Democrats on the evenly divided committee, which does most of its work in secret, voted to release the report, as Gaetz at the time had been Donald Trump's pending ridiculous nominee to be the next attorney general. The decision to release the report now, according to CNN, suggests that some Republicans, or at least one of them on the committee, ultimately decided to side with Democrats on the matter, though they note that it is still unclear if the committee will once again change course now that it has voted, which would be a shame for my holiday reading list.
I think it's very cute, though, that they're trying to get out of town and release it after they're gone.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck getting out of town at all at this point. And I suppose, you know, if they got a lot of pressure from Trump to not release this report, that they would do that. But Gaetz has, you know, dropped out of consideration for the AG post. He's announced he's going to host a show on a far-right news outlet. I'm not sure Trump needs much more from this guy anymore. Why would he do him any favors? Why would he waste political capital on him, especially on a guy that many Republicans already hate in Congress? The committee reportedly revisited the issue behind closed doors earlier this month after a feud over a release of the report before Thanksgiving. The Ethics Committee's report concludes a years-long probe into numerous allegations against Gates, including whether he engaged in sexual misconduct, including sex trafficking minors across state lines and paying them for sex. As reportedly, at least two of the victims are said to have testified to the committee whether he used illicit drugs and, according to the panel's announcement over the summer, quote, shared inappropriate images or videos on the House floor, misused state ID identification records, converted campaign funds to personal use and or accepted a bribe, improper gratuity or impermissible gift. I don't know why he, wouldn't have been the perfect guy to be the nation's top law enforcement officer under Donald Trump.
Yes, it depends on what your standards are.
Yeah. Well, standards? What standards? In more important, if less salacious news today, sorry in advance about that, in an update on a story that we've been following, as you know by now, the great, incredibly closely divided battleground state of North Carolina voted for Donald Trump in November, but in almost all of the key statewide races, Democrats were victorious for governor, for lieutenant governor, attorney general, secretary of state, superintendent of public instruction. Statewide voters selected Democrats. They also picked up enough seats in the state legislature to overcome the Republican Party's wildly gerrymandered supermajority that has, for the last few years, allowed the party to override the vetoes of the state's current outgoing Democratic governor, which is why, in the lame duck session before next year's new term begins, Republicans in the state legislature passed a huge new law under the guise of a relief bill for Hurricane Helene that essentially strips all of the incoming statewide Democratic officials of much of their key powers. Meanwhile, on the state Supreme Court, which is also now controlled by Republicans and who declared the state legislature's unlawful gerrymander to become lawful after all, well, on the Supreme Court, one of the two remaining Democrats on that high court, Justice Allison Riggs, she was up for re-election in November, and she appears to have narrowly defeated her Republican challenger, Judge Jefferson Griffin, after both a machine count in the race and a partial hand recount. Last week, as Democracy Docket reports, the North Carolina State Board of Elections said that it will not order a full hand recount for GOP Supreme Court candidate Jefferson Griffin after a partial recount confirmed incumbent Justice Allison Riggs' victory. Of course, this sort of thing may be just one reason why the outgoing Republican supermajority in the House has voted to strip the Democratic governor the ability to appoint members to the State Board of Elections. Griffin first requested and received a machine recount back in November. North Carolina law allows statewide candidates to request a recount if there are 10,000 votes or less between the first and second place candidates. And in this race, it was more than close enough for that. At the time that he requested that count, Riggs led him, Griffin, by just 623 votes out of more than 5.5 million tabulated statewide. Following the machine recount, the State Board of Elections released the final numbers of that, and it found that Riggs was ahead of Griffin by 734 votes. So that count actually increased the Democrats' lead over the Republican, who then requested a hand count, at least a partial hand count, to which the state board said it would randomly select precincts to conduct hand counts as state law allows, and if the results differed significantly enough from the machine recount results, those in those small random partial hand counts, a sample of precincts in all 100 counties, if they were different enough, the results, then the board would order a full statewide hand count. Well, following that small hand count audit, the state board said in a news release that after that count, Riggs picked up even more votes over Griffin.
Wow.
She garnered 70 more votes in the small sample of precincts across the state compared to 56 more votes also for Griffin. So they both picked up votes via a hand count that were apparently not counted in either of the original two counts or not seen as valid votes by the machines when the machines counted the hand-marked paper ballots. And I don't know how many ballots were actually tabulated by hand in the sampling of those precincts, but in a race that close, divided by just 734 votes after the second machine count out of more than 5.5 million, well, that sounds like quite a few completely missed votes for voters who were essentially disenfranchised in this race by those computer tabulators, at least until this partial hand count. As we reported earlier in the week, a hand count of issues on the ballot in Ashtabula County, Ohio, at the beginning of the month, not only discovered additional previously uncounted votes, but the hand counts ended up changing the results in three different tax levy issues that were on the ballot, which were originally reported as having failed, as having been rejected by voters. Turns out, three of those issues were actually adopted by voters, including one for much-needed funding to local schools. But that hand count only happened after it was discovered, again, thanks to a hand count of one of the issues on that ballot. About a month after the November election, it was discovered that all of the computer-tabulated results for all of the county initiatives from November 5th were tabulated in error due to what has been called a programming error in those tabulators. So, A, thank God that they had hand-marked paper ballots to count in the first place.
Yeah, and no kidding.
B, thank God that they actually bothered to hand count them, which the vast majority of jurisdictions across the country do not do before certifying and finalizing election results. So in close races, my God, as close as it is in North Carolina, I don't really know how they can justify not hand counting all of the ballots in North Carolina. Especially after both of them picked up votes in just a small sampling. But the Democrat picked up more votes. In order for a full hand recount to be conducted, according to state law, the Republican, Griffin, would have had to have picked up at least 35 more votes than Riggs in 3% of the Election Day precincts and early voting sites in each county, according to the State Board of Elections in their announcement. Thus, there will not be a full hand count of that race, apparently, which frankly seems to me to be a disservice to voters, given how close the race was and how many votes were found to have been uncounted or miscounted originally, as discovered via two different recounts, one by machine and one partial one by hand. And as I say that as someone who is very happy to see the Democrat in that case to have been declared the winner. But I think all of the votes that all of the voters deserve to have all of those votes hand counted. Meanwhile, the state board is also considering thousands of ballot challenges, tens of thousands that have been filed, that were filed in November by the Republican Griffin. When he initially requested his machine recount, he also challenged the validity of more than 60,000 ballots, hoping to see them tossed out, I guess, including ones that were cast by voters with prior felony convictions, people whose voter registrations may have been incomplete, and military and overseas voters. That challenge by the Republican hoping to disenfranchise some 60,000 voters after the election, well, I find that to be pathetic, to be anti-small-d Democratic and un-American, but that's how Republicans roll these days. Anything to win, I guess, or hold on to power, no matter how many voters get rolled over in the bargain. They don't care. Ironically, that challenge to those 60,000 voters may make its way up to, guess where? the GOP-controlled state Supreme Court.
Oh, goody.
So stay tuned. Riggs has filed a brief urging the board to deny all of Griffin's protests in that case. Of course, Jefferson Griffin in North Carolina is hardly the only Republican hoping to trample voting rights and, if possible, change either voting laws or their interpretation in order to gain political power. Republicans have been doing exactly that, especially since Trump's lies about his 2020 election being stolen from him. And as he comes back to the White House, of course, he's vowing to change election and voting laws on a national level. But campaign rhetoric, that's one thing. Actually changing long-established laws or the way that they have been interpreted by the courts for decades, that's quite another matter. As noted, we will be joined momentarily by an election law expert to discuss what Trump may or may not be able to do, presuming he meets a strong opposition out there, as we might hope for in his new term. But the gap between what Trump and his supporters promise to do and what they're actually able to do or will be allowed to do, well, that's something that I've been thinking a whole lot about lately, particularly, Desi, as you have been reporting on your Green News reports about plans that Republicans have to reverse landmark climate laws and executive actions and regulations that have been adopted by the Biden administration. You may recall about a week ago or so on Meet the Press with Kristen Welker in Trump's first sit-down interview since winning the November election, he had this to say regarding his plans for what he hopes to do to reverse the progress made on environmental issues during the Biden years.
I understand that on day one, you're going to be signing a flurry of executive orders. Can you give me just what are the top ones people should know about?
A lot's going to have to do with energy. We're going to end the electric mandate immediately for the cars. It's ridiculous. We want people to buy electric cars. Yeah, we want people to buy electric cars. But you know what? They have to be able to, if they want gasoline powered, if they want hybrids, they got to have that. So we're going to be ending that. We're going to be ending a lot of the environmental things that were ridiculous, that hurt our country very badly and didn't do anything for the environment. So we'll be doing, you know, standard things.
Yeah, you know, standard things. Standard things that that Republicans do when they take power that make people, I don't know, sicker, that cause far more damage to the planet and humanity itself and cost people a whole lot more money, you know. Standard things.
Well, it is what Republicans do.
And by the way, there is no EV mandate. Reuters, in an exclusive this week, reports some of the specific details on just some of those standard things that the Trump administration is planning, is hoping to do, is threatening to do after taking office, perhaps on day one, as Trump claimed to Welker in that interview. According to Reuters, incoming U.S. President Donald Trump's transition team is recommending sweeping changes to cut off support for electric vehicles and charging stations, even though there is no mandate, and to strengthen measures blocking cars, components, and battery materials from China, according to documents seen by Reuters. The recommendations, which have been not previously been reported, come as the U.S. electric vehicle transition stalls. Stalls? Reuters?
Not really.
You hear a lot of people say that. In fact, growth has slowed down.
Growth of sales has slowed down slightly.
Still at record numbers.
Yes.
But growth has slowed down a little bit
just
in those
rate.
Record sales. Right. So it comes as transition stalls. China's heavily subsidized EV industry does continue to surge, in part because of its battery supply chain that is superior to ours. On the campaign trail, Trump vowed to ease regulations on fossil fuel cars and roll back what he calls President Biden's EV mandate, which is not a mandate. There is no EV mandate, no matter how many times he says it or tries to say it into existence. The transition team also recommends imposing tariffs on all battery materials globally in a bid to boost U.S. production and then negotiate individual exemptions with allies, according to the documents. Now, by allies here, they mean countries or companies who bend the knee to Trump, essentially, as we discussed a week or two ago with the American Prospect's David Dayan, who describes how these tariffs are an unprecedented avenue for grift for Donald Trump. Buy a few million dollars worth of Trump's cryptocurrency, for example, and well, bingo, suddenly you're an ally, and the threats of tariffs against your industry, against your company's products or your country's products, well, those can be waived. He has that power, which is why Donald Trump loves tariffs. Taken together, Reuters says the recommendations are a stark departure from Biden administration policy, which sought to balance encouraging a domestic battery supply chain separate from China with a rapid EV transition and billions in loan guarantees to companies who build battery factories here, as they are now doing all over the country. The Trump transition team, their plan would be to redirect money now flowing to building charging stations and making EVs affordable into national defense priorities. The Trump transition team also calls for eliminating the Biden administration's $7,500 tax credit for people who buy EVs. So, act now, as they say. The policies could strike a blow to U.S. EV sales and production at a time when many legacy automakers like General Motors have recently introduced a wide array of electric offerings to the U.S. market. So, yes, you heard that right. The Trump team wants to harm the U.S. auto market, including the sales of General Motors in favor of fossil fuel companies who really, really don't want America to realize how much better electric vehicles are than internal combustion engine cars in almost every respect. Cutting government EV support could also hurt sales of Elon Musk's Tesla, Reuters claims. They are, of course, the dominant EV seller in this country. But Musk, who spent more than $250 million helping to elect Donald Trump, has said he's fine with that, that losing subsidies would hurt rivals more than Tesla. And so I guess that's because Tesla is so well established. They're already selling enough cars that if they cut back the rebates, the tax credits and so forth, that will help more of these emerging car markets like General Motors and Tesla will do just fine.
Yeah, I believe that that is the calculation that Elon Musk is making, that because, as you say, Tesla is so well established, it will undercut the opening efforts of the U.S. automakers to broaden their EV offerings and do better.
The transition team is calling for clawing back whatever funds remain from Biden's $7.5 billion plan to build charging stations and shifting the money to, quote, the national defense supply chain and critical infrastructure. Trump transition spokesperson Carolyn Leavitt said that voters gave Trump a mandate to deliver on campaign promises, including stopping government attacks on gas-powered cars. Government attacks on gas-powered cars? A mandate? Really? More Americans, by the way, voted against Donald Trump than for him. So if there is a mandate for anything, it is to not do what Donald Trump has threatened to do. The Trump team recommendations would allow automakers to produce more gas-powered vehicles by rolling back emissions and fuel economy standards championed by the Biden administration, because Americans really want dirtier air and more extreme climate change-fueled weather disasters, I guess, right? 25% more polluting emissions per vehicle mile than the current 2025 limits. That's what they want, 25% more polluting emissions.
Yep.
And the proposal recommends blocking California from setting its own stricter vehicle emission standards. It calls for rolling back the standards that Joe Biden had put in place that, again, lower emissions to make fewer people sick and improve your gas mileage and save you money. But rolling back the California standards and their allowance to set their own stricter vehicle emission standards That's something that about a dozen other states have adopted as well, California's standards. So Trump initially barred California from setting tougher requirements. Biden reversed that decision by the first Trump administration. Now he plans to reverse it, to reverse the reversal, I guess, to prevent California and other states from having cleaner air and fewer deaths from pollution. And for residents to, you know, have to force them to pay more for gas. So much for states' rights when it comes to this sort of thing. Desi, I believe news came down today, by the way, because California is asking to approval for stricter standards still. I believe news came down today that the Biden EPA has, in fact, approved that request from California.
Yes. So what happened was that the Biden EPA approved California's special authority to set tougher emissions and pollution limits than the federal standard. It was established by law, by Congress, decades ago to solve California's really bad pollution crisis. What the EPA did was they approved California's phase out of sales of new gasoline-powered cars in 2035, 11 years from now. That does not apply to used cars and light trucks, just sales of new ones.
So you'll still be able to get gas cars, you'll still be able to get hybrid cars.
Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, they expect, of course, that Trump will try to revoke that that EPA waiver again, like he did in his first term. But that will set in motion a massive legal battle between California and the Trump administration and the states that follow California and a number of automakers who are electric only.
So he can't just necessarily come in, especially after the EPA has approved it under the previous administration. He can't necessarily come in and just change it back with a stroke of his pen. And all of these things he's talking about, these issues on electric vehicles and other environmental issues on day one, much of this is now in federal law. The Inflation Reduction Act, the Infrastructure Act, and so forth passed during the Biden years. So how much can Trump simply reverse or roll back on day one with his magical executive orders as he is claiming or threatening to do?
So he's got three different pathways. One of them is only regarding the agency regulations and rules. That's something that he can declare to have it done. But again, that will then run through the very long litigation and rulemaking process.
That can be challenged. It takes a long time to change rules, et cetera.
And
they can be challenged
rules,
in court.
To repromulgate those rules and challenge them in court. And also there's another way that they called the Congressional Review Act that congressional Republicans, with him signing the bill, can overturn any regulations that were passed in the last 6 months. But, you know, that is also a process that will also trigger lawsuits. So there it won't be happening instantly. That's the short version.
Not on day one, I guess.
Right.
So, yeah, I know a lot of people are freaking out about what Donald Trump is going to do. A lot of what he's promising is not going to be quite as easy as he makes it sound. And there are challenges that can be made pretty much every step of the way. Anyway, along those lines, let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with election law professor Josh Douglas on whether Trump can make changes to voting and election laws that he's been promising as well. May not be as easy as he thinks. That's straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
What is wrong? And the evidence is clear. I'm not alone. There are thousands of us here. This is my democracy. You won't go telling me my vote don't matter anymore. And is not worth fighting.
We're still fighting for it right here on the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. That is, of course, the late, great Victoria Parks out of our Columbus, Ohio affiliate, WGRN. Welcome back. So over the past year, Donald Trump made a lot of promises about stuff that he was going to do often on day one, as he often claims, to not only reverse Biden-era progress on all sorts of things like climate law, etc., but when it comes to things like elections and voting law, he has vowed to overturn or reverse decades of well-established laws, particularly following his loss to Joe Biden in 2020 and his persistent lies that he actually won that election. But all of the fraud for which he has shown zero evidence, but for that he would have won, and but for the terrible voting laws that allow all sorts of mischief, like millions of immigrants, non-citizen voters, which, by the way, there is also zero evidence of. As election law expert Joshua A. Douglas writes at the Washington Monthly this week, at an event on December 7, Trump stated, quote, "We want to have paper ballots, one-day voting, voter ID, and proof of citizenship," unquote. This statement echoed one of the priorities he listed on his campaign website, quote, "Secure our elections, including same-day voting, voter identification, paper ballots, and proof of citizenship." Donald Trump has bold ideas for changing our elections, writes Douglas. While most of his proposals would make our voting rules worse, there is a silver lining, he says. Given the decentralized nature of our election system, Donald Trump has little official power to implement the new rules that he supports. Joining us now to discuss what Trump can and can't do, at least from his own perch in office when it comes to election and voting laws, is Professor Joshua A. Douglas, who teaches election law, voting rights, and constitutional law at the University of Kentucky College of Law. He's also the author of a number of recent books on related matters, including 2019's Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting, and more recently this year, I believe, The Court Versus the Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. Josh also is now the host of a public radio series and podcast on democratic processes, elections, and voting rights, exploring the question, how do we sustain our democracy? Which seems like an excellent question to me right about now. That podcast and a Substack newsletter that goes with it is called Democracy Optimist, which is also something I might welcome right about now. Professor Douglas, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks, Brad. Great to be back, as always.
So, listen, before we get into the details, I'm wondering, Josh, have you come to regret the name of your new podcast and newsletter, Democracy Optimist, given the events of the last month or so?
Not at all. In fact, I think it is even more important to send a message, because optimism is not, I think everything is great. Optimism is, I think there's a path to reach greater heights. I think there's a path forward. And I think we have to be optimistic, or else, you know, you throw up your hands in despair and say, you know, defeatism is essentially taking over. So, you know, I am self-described as a democracy optimist, not because I think our democracy is strong right now or things are all wonderful, but that we need to continue fighting forward, because otherwise defeatism will take over. So I'm an optimist because what's the alternative?
I hear you, and I'm right there with you, man. Thank you for that. Now, let's get into some of the reasons to maybe not be so optimistic, but we'll see. Your piece this week at Washington Monthly argues that, quote, as president, Trump does not have the authority to administer elections, that the Constitution essentially vests most power to determine how elections are run to the states. Before I try to challenge that a bit, tell me about the balance of state versus federal power when it comes to election law.
So a lot of people lament the fact that our elections are so decentralized. That is, that it's really localities that run elections. Often I say we don't really have one election day. We have 50 or 51, including DC, election days. But actually, we have thousands of election days that all happen at the same time, because it's the localities that run our system. Mm-hmm. And it's really state laws that are most paramount. Even the U.S. Constitution gives authority to the states to regulate elections, at least in the first instance. Now, the Constitution says Congress can make or alter those regulations, and Congress certainly has stepped in some, but it's really a process of local control. And so the president himself cannot, you know, issue an executive order or some sort of decree that elections should be changed one way or the other without the states really being the ones to pass those laws or Congress. But of course, that's a difficult path as well.
It is, although they have passed a lot of laws throughout our history, from the Voting Rights Act in 1965 to the National Voter Registration Act in 1993, to Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, in 2002, to the Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment, or MOVE Act, in 2009. That does sound like a lot of federal power over elections, but Congress is needed to change or reverse or somehow add to those laws at the federal level. No, unless a corrupt activist U.S. Supreme Court majority does it first.
Yeah, I mean, it would take Congress. And although Republicans control both houses right now, those majorities are pretty slim. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I question, take the SAVE Act about non-citizen voting and requiring proof of citizenship, which Congress, you know, looked at this year, but didn't pass even in with the Republican majority. Now, they might have the votes to do it, but I wouldn't say it's a sure thing.
So what, if any, setting Congress aside for the moment, what, if any, power does an actual president actually have? You know, we've been talking about, a lot of people are kind of freaked out. Donald Trump is making the promises he's going to do this thing or that thing on day one. What power does he actually have beyond the bully pulpit to sort of muscle or bend Congress or the courts to his will? Does the president actually have any control or any say over our elections?
Yeah, exactly. The president doesn't have any power unilaterally to dictate election rules. Now, you mentioned the bully pulpit. Certainly, Trump can, you know, raise priorities and try to convince Congress to pass various laws. Indirectly, the president, of course, appoints the justices of the Supreme Court and the lower court federal judges, and so he can reshape the judiciary in a way that could be more favorable to his views on voting rights. It's already happened, of course. But the president, under the Constitution, has no formal powers to regulate elections beyond signing or vetoing a congressional law, just like for any other type of congressional law. You know, the president also can appoint members to the Federal Election Commission, but by law, they have to be, you know, split between Democrats and Republicans. The same with this little known agency, the Election Assistance Commission, which that agency doesn't really have much power anyway.
The EAC, yeah.
Yeah, and then the president obviously can tell the Department of Justice what priorities it should have, what sorts of challenges it should bring under the Voting Rights Act. So it's not to say the president has no powers, but in terms of dictating voting rules, the Constitution gives the president no powers.
Let's step through some of the specific points that Trump has been calling for, even as recently as a week or so ago, as you cite in your article. That was from a Fox News-sponsored event in New York, including what he describes as changes to mandate paper ballots, one-day voting, voter ID, and proof of citizenship. So let's sort of step through those one at a time. He called for paper ballots, which, by the way, if they are not hand-marked paper ballots, which can actually, you know, be verifiable as reflecting voter intent, in my opinion, those don't mean all that much. But on this point, presuming it is hand-marked paper ballots that he's referring to here, and I think he doesn't know what he's referring to, on this one, I'm actually on his side. But the vast majority of ballots cast right now, frankly, thanks to some tireless work by voting system experts and cybersecurity experts and election integrity folks over the years, actually are already paper ballots, despite Trump's repeated claims about them and suggestions that they are not, correct?
Yeah, it's sort of funny that he's demanding it's the first on his list. We need paper ballots. And yet, basically everywhere does it. I cite I think it's a Brennan Center report that says that 98% of jurisdictions already use paper ballots. So good news, Trump, we're already there on that. Now, he might be referring to wanting to do paper counts, the, you know, human counts of the ballots as opposed to machine counts.
Hand counts.
But, yeah, but virtually every election expert will tell you that that's a terrible idea as well. Humans are not that good at routine counting as compared to a machine, unless you're in a situation of a recount, you know, you're very close and you need to scrutinize each ballot. Mm-hmm. When you're counting the ballots and they have, you know, 10, 15 different measures on it, humans make mistakes all the time. And so paper ballots, in terms of the voters, are the best practice. Machines doing the initial count is also the best practice. I think Trump doesn't really know what he's talking about or what
Correct.
He wants.
Yeah.
But certainly on the paper ballots, we're there.
Because I would certainly challenge the notion about whether they're more accurate or not. Thank you for adding that caveat that in the closest of elections, we do want to hand count and find out. And like I said, if he had called for hand-marked paper ballots, I'd be joining him in that because there are, you know, states like Georgia where we've got these touchscreen systems. They're not the only states that are questionable, but he doesn't seem to know the difference. That said, I would note, more disturbing, he calls for one-day voting, by which I guess he means no early voting, no absentee voting. You're either available and healthy enough and, you know, don't have to work that day so that you could show up at a voting precinct or you lose your right to vote. Is that essentially what he's calling for when he says over and over again, one-day voting?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, right? I mean, I think the idea is to do away with absentee balloting unless you have an excuse and to do away with early voting days. But this one, I think, is unlikely to happen in many places because people like early voting. People like absentee voting. It adds to the convenience. And especially once you give people that convenience factor, it's pretty hard to take it away. And election officials, and this is where I think it's really important to engage election officials in the conversations about some of these proposals, because they're not going to want to do away with these processes that they've already set up. It, you know, relieves the pressure on the official election day itself, the last day of voting.
Mm-hmm.
They spent the time and the money to implement these things. So I think even members of his own party will, if they understand kind of what he's proposing, will reject it. Again, just because of the logistical hassle for running elections and for election officials.
And is there any law at the federal level that would need to be changed in order to mandate that in all 50 states? Or would it essentially be a new law that would have to be pushed through to require that?
Yeah, I think it would be either a federal law that, you know, bans a certain, you know, early voting or absentee voting, or going state by state to do it. And, you know, that's, again, you know, because our elections are so decentralized, you can't just wave a magic wand and say, you know, now you're not going to have early voting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is federal law already, as you mentioned, with respect to overseas voters, mm-hmm. military voters. There's actually two federal laws that do mandate certain deadlines for absentee voting mm-hmm. for people overseas. And so, you know, that is also part of the consideration here. And, you know, good luck telling members of the military that we're going to make it harder for you to cast a ballot while you're overseas. In the military.
Well, don't put it past them, Josh. I mean, Republicans were actually challenging military and overseas ballots this year, you know, trying to prevent them from being able to vote in some cases, trying to prevent them from coming in late. If they come in late, don't count them. So, I mean, I don't be surprised. I think if they do try that, whether, you know, that how well that goes over, well, that remains to be seen. Trump also calls for what he calls voter ID. But the Help America Vote Act, Josh, at the federal level already mandates that all new voters in all 50 states when registering must show some form of ID. And a majority of states already mandate some form of voter ID when casting a vote. So what is he calling for here? And again, what laws would be needed to be amended or overturned in order to require it?
Well, you know, when you say voter ID, that's a pretty broad term mm-hmm. for lots of different kinds of rules and laws. So the Help America Vote Act of 2002 does require any new registrants who register online to provide some kind of ID when they vote for the first time. But it can be a utility bill, a piece of mail. It's pretty mm-hmm. broad. It's not a photo identification. But the trend, as you know, has been for states to impose photo identification requirements on voters, first in-person voters. But now there's also been states passing these rules for mail-in or absentee ballots where you have to provide a copy of your ID or when you're requesting your ballot online, put mm-hmm. in some kind of identifying information. But as you said, about three quarters of the states already have a photo ID requirement that goes beyond the Help America Vote Act. And they come in different shapes and different flavors in terms of the kinds of IDs that are allowed or required. You know, the example that lots of people always mention is that in Texas, your student ID issued by the University of Texas does right. not count for voting, but your gun license does.
Right.
In my state of Kentucky, we have a more open standard. Student IDs count. It doesn't matter if the ID has been expired mm-hmm. or not. So there's all different kinds of ID laws. I guess Trump is suggesting that we have a national requirement for voter ID, but I would wonder which one of the voter ID laws is he looking at? Is he, you know, as you said, we already have a national one with respect to first-time voters who registered online. Mm-hmm. Does he want the Texas or North Carolina model, which pretty clearly has been found to have a discriminatory effect?
Yes.
Or does he want the Kentucky model, which, you know, is still a photo ID law, but has a lot of fail-safe mechanisms in the law itself?
No,
again, this is the sort of thing that is already happening in most places anyways.
Yeah, no, he wants the most discriminatory one, Josh. I think that's clear because and we know this because, you know, those of us who have been fighting against these photo ID restrictions for, well, now a couple of decades in my case, you know, when Republicans started this fight for photo ID restrictions, it only applied to the precincts, to voting at the precincts, because back then more Republicans used absentee voting than Democrats. Things have changed now. Now it's more Democrats who use vote by mail. And so now all of a sudden Republicans, you know, are demanding photo ID somehow, you know, along with your vote by mail, your absentee vote. So clearly, when they're calling for these very specific type of IDs, they know that millions of largely Democratic-leaning voters do not have that type of ID that they are calling for. As you note, you know, there's a lot of different flavors here, and you know, you can vote with a utility bill, a paycheck, or whatever. They don't care. This, in my opinion, this is about voter suppression, not voter ID, when we hear that.
Yeah, word. I mean, of course, we know that voter ID laws don't actually prevent any kind of fraud that's actually in the system, right? The only kind of fraud it could prevent is in-person impersonation, and that simply just doesn't happen. All that said, I actually suspect that the voter ID debate is still going to be ongoing, but perhaps less prevalent than the next topic I think we're going to talk about, which is proof of citizenship.
Yeah.
In part because, you know, even so many Democrats in the abstract approve and support voter ID laws. Three quarters of the states already have these requirements. So you're talking about maybe 12 states that don't. And I'd have to look at the map again to see which ones, but I think they're mostly kind of the more blue states that don't have the strict requirements. I just don't think this is going to be as big of a fight as it was, you know, from the past 5 years, as compared to this proof of citizenship issue, which is a big one.
It's a real big one. Currently, only Arizona, I think, requires it. But even there, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that all voters, even without submitting such proof of citizenship to the state, whatever that might be, that they must be allowed to vote in at least federal elections. So is that something that can be changed by Trump or his Congress at the federal level? I mean, does the Constitution block something like that?
Again, Trump can't do it by himself. So he can't just, you know, state a mandate or file an executive order that mm-hmm. says states have to require proof of citizenship now. But yes, Congress could pass a law, as they tried to last year with the SAVE Act, that would have required states to make voters show proof of citizenship. You mentioned Arizona. So a voter who registers without proof of citizenship is put on a federal-only list, and a voter who does show that proof of citizenship gets put on a separate list where they can vote for both federal and state offices. Mm-hmm. And that's a real logistical nightmare for election officials.
Yeah.
Because now they have to, you know, have more than one voter list that they have to maintain statewide. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this is an area where the election officials, I think, will say, you know, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't have a federal mandate. Because even if Congress enacted a rule that said all people registering to vote have to show proof of citizenship, that would only apply to federal elections. Congress could not say, and also you need to require this for state elections.
Right.
So the states who didn't, would, you know, some states, I guess, would just go along and say, okay, you need proof of citizenship for every election in the state. And I think the change to some state constitutions that has been going on over the past several years that limit voting to only citizens within the state constitutional protection perhaps would support a state doing that. But there are certainly states that will say, look, no, we're not going to require proof of citizenship for our state elections. And that is an election official's disaster with respect to administering a fair and free election. So there are a lot of hurdles here to get something like that pass on a national level.
And it should let the record show that this year, when it turned out there was an actual glitch in the voter registration database that meant tens of thousands of voters were actually marked as having presented proof of citizenship in Arizona, but it turns out they hadn't. When there was a question about whether those voters should be allowed to vote in the state election, and they had a really, you know, they got a really tight state legislative election. They had one in November in Arizona. It was actually the Republicans saying, no, let those people vote even without proof of citizenship, because as it turns out, more of the people who were affected by that glitch were actually Republican voters. So they're not all that concerned about proof of citizenship, as far as I can tell.
It's always about politics, yeah, right? They think that people who can't show the proof of citizenship are going to vote more Democratic.
Yeah.
But here's the key thing. There's, studies suggest it's about 10% of people don't have easy access to documents to show proof of citizenship. These are bona fide Americans who are going to be denied the right to vote under these requirements.
And 10% amounts to millions of voters. When it comes just to voter ID alone, never mind citizen proof of citizenship, which is much harder to prove or show, just on photo ID, the type of strict restrictions they're talking about, we're talking about 20 or 30 million Americans who do not have that type of ID, but who are eligible to vote. Finally, Josh, and I got to get out because I'm running short today, but what about at the state level? Never mind Donald Trump. I know that one of Trump's crooked 2020 lawyers, Cleta Mitchell, has been working with Republicans at the state level to sort of do all of these things since 2020, since they've been running around pretending that Donald Trump won that election. How concerned, if not about Donald Trump, what he does in office, how concerned should we be about his minions at the state level over the next few years when it comes to these types of laws and restrictions?
Yeah, this is the genuine concern. And one of the reasons I wrote that piece in Washington Monthly is to say, like, look, let's make sure we focus where the problems are and not on the latest crazy thing that the incoming president has said. Cleta Mitchell is working with this group called ALEC, mm-hmm. and they already had a lot of success for their side on the voter ID issue. I mean, they proposed model legislation back in, I think it was 2007 or 2008, that a lot of these states with strict photo ID laws then adopted. So if they're doing the same thing, the same model of proposing, you know, legislation and sending to the various states, and they have people in the state legislatures all over the country proposing these laws, that's where I think the real issues could be with respect to some of these voter suppression yep. rules being passed. So that's why I think, you know, talking to your state legislator, talking to local and statewide election officials about the best ways, because, you know, the truth is most state election officials are really great servants of democracy who want to run smooth and easy election processes. Yep. And they're going to oppose a lot of these laws, not all of them, but a lot of them. But yes, I think this push at the state level, at the state legislature level, that's where I am most concerned and where we could see a lot of problems moving forward.
And where we need voters to step up and fight that fight rather than necessarily freaking out about what Donald Trump is going to do at the federal level. It is a state-by-state fight. And as you note in your piece at Washington Monthly, which we will link to, voters do play a significant role in this debate, at least on that local level. Joshua A. Douglas is a professor of election law at the University of Kentucky College of Law, and his latest book, perfect for Christmas, is called The Court Versus the Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. You can find his work at joshuaadouglas.com. You can find his podcast at democracyoptimist.substack.com. Do I have that right, Josh?
Yeah, or just actually democracyoptimist.com will take you to the podcast itself.
Beautiful. There you go. And you can also find him now on the blue skies at Joshua A. Douglas. Josh, really appreciate you joining us today. Hope you have a happy, safe, and warm holiday. And I look forward to speaking to you in the new year, my friend.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you. All right. You know, there are a lot of things to be worried about with the upcoming Trump administration. I'm not trying to downplay the concerns that we should have. I'm trying to focus them, and try to understand what is and isn't a real threat so we can sort of prioritize.
Yeah, and help people understand how they can step in and take action themselves. Like Josh saying, voters will play a significant role at the state and local level on these voting laws. So there's a place to work.
Prioritize where you put your panic and fear.
Yes.
All right. Got to get out. Thanks again to Josh Douglas. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night. Thanks, of course, to our producer, Desi Doyen. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. That's made possible by those of you who hit a donate button or go to bradblog.com/donate. To keep us in mind for your end of year giving. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, including Blue Sky, I am now the Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.